show has gotten on the road, so to speak.
Well, have you gone back as far as the legislation and rationale for why it was set up? As a college, it was originally a college for math and science teachers. I mean, that was the real emphasis. In order to even get a college of the State University down in Long Island at that time, that's the only way that they could get the budget and legislature to agree. You know, the State University trustees at that time and the Board of Regents really had a great deal of conflicts. And so that college actually was originally approved at the outset. Now, there wasn't much intention, from the way I understood things at the time, that they would actually follow through and concentrate on that particular specific direction that the college was supposed to take. I mean, there was the intent of the university, quite frankly, to develop a liberal arts program there with a strong emphasis in sciences for the Stony Brook campus. But the connotation of the teachers quickly disappeared from state universities. I mean, I assume you've got all of that.
That's in the correspondence. There is correspondence.
Yes. I can give you some interesting stories on how it actually got started.
This I would like to know, because that won't be in the minutes of the trustees and that sort of thing.
No, well,
what was your position at that time?
I was associate university architect under Otto Tegan.
Yes.
But it wasn't too long before I was put in the position of being director of planning and development. Now, in state, that generally is a term in university circles for, I guess, fundraising. But it was a term used at that particular time, meaning exactly what it said, planning and development. In other words, I was selected by Freddie Greenman, who was a member of the Board of Trustees. He's an old member of the board, and Frank Moore for this particular position. I don't know. I guess they looked around, and I guess I was as good as anybody they could find at the time. And my particular assignment was to try to develop a method of projecting the, as in planning, from a planning standpoint, projecting the facilities needs and the really kind of the university structure and the to put together a plan, you know what I mean, that we could use. We were heading into, at that particular time, the bond issue. This is the old 250, there was going to be a series of four, 250, that was Frank Moore's idea, four $250 million bond issues. I mean, we went after the first one. The first one was voted and approved. In fact, it was approved with the highest majority of any bond issue ever put on the voters' rolls in the history of bond issues in New York State at that time.
When was that?
Oh, God, I can't give you the dates. Carl, you're asking me, I'd have to go back and look in my files, but you'd have to see when the bond issue was approved. That was, it's in the 50s.
Yes.
Yeah, the 50s.
Did Mitchell have anything to do with suggesting the financing, or method of financing? Because I've heard that.
Oh, wait a minute. He came way, way later. My God, he's so far down the pike that has no relationship to this.
All right.
I'm giving you, in terms of what you're asking, I'm giving you from my particular recollection and whatever you could find in the correspondence, the early beginnings of Stony Brook.
Right, all right.
Stony Brook, you know, it had such a disastrous beginning, including a means the university used, I mean, what I told you about the science and engineering, aspects of teaching, not science and engineering, science and mathematics and teaching, of how the hell Stony Brook ever got finally on its feet, because there were all kinds of roadblocks put in the way.
Can you cite any of them?
Oh, yeah, including that guy Lee that they had as president one time, which was one of the biggest ones that they had. Didn't you take over after he bombed?
Yes. Say, I came September 62.
Yeah, well, that's when we started the construction firm. But I'm giving you now 50s.
All right. Okay.
All right. Well, anyway, we got the legislation passed, and I was sitting in the Capitol over in the old flag room. All of our, Charlie Foster and the whole bunch of us were up in the Capitol at that time. That's when we operated with deans, and we had four deans, a dean for medical colleges, a dean for two-year colleges and community colleges, that was Larry Jarvie, and you had Reuben Froden, who was the dean for the four-year colleges and sort of the, and Cornell, and you had Herman Cooper, who was the dean of the teacher style. Well, the original legislation, obviously this would have come under Herman Cooper, but there were a lot of problems in the central office going on at the same time, including questions as to whether Carlson was there as president at the time, including whether Carlson was really, how long, it was just a matter of time as to how long he was going to last, and there was all kinds of things that came out, including the Blagan report. I don't know if you ever ran into that or not.
I need to get a copy of it. But
well, the Blagan report was a report done by this guy Blagan, a guy who later became congressman, got fired from State University over that Blagan report because he was the director of public relations. He was let go. And whether that was that was paid for by the Research Foundation, I don't know. Mort Grant could give you. His name was.
Was it Froud? F-R-O-E-D?
No. His name. He was a local guy, and he got elected to Congress after that. I'll think of his name.
Okay.
Any event. The Blagan Report called for a major central state university. It was not in keeping with the thinking that we were sort of doing and discussing with the trustees in terms of the structure. Now, I got in on a lot of that stuff because as Director of Planning and Development, I was working with the trustees on what structure the university would take. And we early on discussed the system of university centers and colleges and, that particular kind of a hierarchy. And then major emphasis at different places, too. And quite frankly, in our book, Stony Brook was to, if it was going to develop, would develop eventually as it did today, the university center. So that kind of thinking was very early. But due to the Blagan report and the problems that this entailed on Carlson's days were sort of nebulous. And Carlson had sort of a problem with Reuben Froden. And Froden, who was out of the University of Chicago, I tell you, one of his first assistants was Stu Gordon, that ended up as provost down at Binghamton. Well, after Stu went down to Binghamton, Reuben Froden brought in Len Olson. But then Carlson saw to it that Reuben Froden left. So Len Olson and I used to go to lunch down in downtown from the campus, down in the YWCA, time and time again. He was a nice guy. Quiet, my God, you couldn't get two words out of him. But I was working my goddamn head off as to what we were going to be doing down there. And here's Len Olson sitting over in his office reading books on philosophy. He was a philosophy major, I think. I went into Carlson one day, and I said, look, if we're going to get this thing started, I got a suggestion in terms of the way we can chart it, but I'm only getting something started from the physical facilities aspects. I says, it isn't going to do us any good to get something started there unless that somebody's got something started, that makes sense in terms of heading down the pike for academic. Somebody's got to go around to the faculty. Well, yes, you're right. He said, what did you have? I said, well, I thought that we could start using Oyster Bay, Planning Field. And I said, I've already talked to a couple people, and I think that we could, in a short period of time, get something done there to get started in a marginal way. But I said, it's a place where you could at least collect the faculty and get going until we get things started out at the other site. The site selection and so on is a different story from this out at Stony Brook.
I need to get that.
Yeah, all right. Well, anyway, but I said, what I suggest is that you take Len Olson, I says, and put him on the road and give him a travel and let him go around and start picking out some people. I says, I no longer got back to my desk and I heard the phone ring and it was for Len Olson across, because he was just across the flag room from me. And Len, I told Len what I was going to do. And he says, "You're kidding." And I said, "No." Well, he said, "That would be very interesting." And so Carlson called him in, and Len Olson was assigned the task of, it was hectic days. Anyway, Len then started, and I started on...
this was around April.
Yep. 87. And we wanted to it was earlier than that, because I remember that we wanted to have some work done so that the following September we could have something going on in planting fields, and that was in February, I remember that. So I think that there was some time in there, you know what I mean? Anyway, it wasn't much time. In fact, we still have the guy that I picked out of the old DPW. And I went to Carl Larson and Charlie Kowecki, who was in DPW at the time, and said, "We need to have some people, and I need to get something done fast." They took Donnie Lambert, but still he's on the way to retire. But anyway, they selected, he was working for the old DPW Division of Architecture at the time, and we assigned him the task of going down to planting fields, which he did. And I went around with the building and said, "This is what we want to use the original planting field building for." We had some other things in terms of, eventually we put some temporary, which we did, some temporary structures there, but we wanted to convert the barns there, you know what I mean, into the thing, and start using the planting field's main house. So he went down there. In fact, he had he slept there in the building. I mean, he and I don't know if he has anybody else, but Donnie stayed down there. Well, we used the stables and converted that into some housing units and a dining hall. Very nice job. But yeah. Donnie stayed in the main building. Oh yeah, he had a room in the main building where he stayed, and we started putting that together in terms of classrooms and office spaces and so on, and some safety things we had to do with it. And they did it very quickly by going around and making a spec and a for each room, and having the contractors come around and bidding on the things that was posted, so that they knew what they had to do in the building. We got the work done that summer, such that Len Olson was able to have an office and able to bring people in that following September. We got the thing done. We started. Now you have to tell me what year that was that we started.
57.
All right. That makes sense.
Started in the fall.
Yeah, 57. And then we went on with there. Of course, the conversion of the stables and the dining hall, the main barn and so on, came a little bit. I mean, that was finished later. And then we put up some metal buildings and some dome-type buildings and different things for for some science labs and
geodesic
domes. Well, we're doing anything that we could get some quick stuff erected, and that was one way of doing it. There's all stories connected with all those things too, but you don't need all those. Any event, we got it started at planting fields. It was a little bit difficult and shaky because even there, Len Olson found that he really wasn't in charge of planting fields, because planting fields was an arm of Farmingdale Ag and Tech Institute. And the guy that was head of the horticulture department, who really got planting fields given to he had an office there.
Yeah.
What was his name?
I'm trying to think.
What the hell was his name? I don't think he's living anymore.
No, he's not.
No. Carl. His name was Carl, too.
It was Carl.
Carl, I'll think of it.
I can look it up.
Carl something. Well, anyway, the office that I had picked for Len Olson, he was occupying, which was just the library, just off of the main entry as you go in. And it took us a while in order to work out the logistical to get him out of there and to
get upstairs.
Put him upstairs and get Len into that. Well, didn't you occupy some of that space at one time?
Yeah, that was my office for 3 years.
Yeah, right. While Stony Brook was still... This was after Len Olson left.
Yes, considerably after.
Yeah.
It was after Lee had gone.
After Lee had gone.
Yeah, I came in September of 62. That was the year that they moved out to Stony Brook.
Yeah.
Everything but the biology labs.
Yeah.
And so I commuted in reverse.
Yeah.
It was, I went out.
Well, we had built that. You were living in the Cole Cottage.
I was,
you and your wife.
Yes.
Yeah, I remember traipsing through there one day, scaring the hell out of her with a whole entourage of people. Well, in any event, all of the things that happened there happened as a result of getting Stony Brook started as a campus and an ongoing. And that's when Len Olson went out, and he's the one that hired Bonner and Eck and and Eisenbud and that particular...
Ekumenik,
Erk. Erk, E-R-K.
Frank
Erk. Frank Erk. He was
biologist.
And Bonner was chemistry.
Yes.
And Eisenbud was physics, I think. And, yeah, they were the three. And then there was a guy in mathematics. I can't think what his name was that they hired. Anyway, they got some very, they had some good people. Lynn did all right in getting started. So, anyway, it was going as a functioning institution. And then Len Olson was no longer in favor of in people's minds, and so things begin to change, as and I think you've got all of that particular path in terms of... but one of the biggest problems, of course, early on was the mistake made in getting this guy Lee in there, because he had, it turns out that he had problems, and it was rather, it was rather obvious rather quickly that he had problems. It was almost impossible to work with.
I believe that Olson brought him in.
He did.
Initially?
Yeah, he did.
Was it a dean of the graduate school? Or
no, I think it was in engineering.
Engineering,
I think so.
Right.
He, yeah. Olson's the guy that brought him in.
Yes.
And then when Olson left, they saw fit to bring Lee. And Lee was a great promoter of himself, but it was just one of these disasters that never should have happened if people had paid attention to him. But they were so anxious to try to keep things going that... and the local council really got buffaloed, and... people paid attention to the local council when it should have really been under closer scrutiny within the central office, I mean, to get things started at that time.
Was he, was Ward Melvin chairman of it then?
Well, I guess he was on the council. Yeah, he might have, as crazy as everything else, he might as well have been on the local council, I'm sure. Yeah.
Well, look.
Now.
All right, you now, go ahead. I don't want to get back to the to why Melville made the offer of the land.
Tax. Tax benefit. Oh, yeah. In the meantime, when we got started, we were looking for sites for the main campus there. And I went down there like I always did on site selection and looked at various places. And then...
What other places did you look at?
Oh, golly. We looked at... I don't know. There ought to be a record of them someplace. I can't tell you. I visited two or three or four places, other places. There were a lot of good sites around at that particular time. There were some estates, and there were, we even, I tell you, we had a master plan done for Planting Fields. Oh, yeah, there was a big area next to it. Oh, yeah, we considered Planting Fields very, very seriously at one time. Absolutely. That was prime in our, until Melville came up with this. Now, there was a guy who was Melville's, Bayless Manus. Well, Melville's, yeah, I don't know if he's still living or not.
No, he's dead. He's dead. See, that's what's happened.
Yeah. Well, anyway, Bayless Manus was his sort of real estate man of Ward Melville. Well, they made contact, and the guy you could talk to about that would be John Slocum.
Where is John?
John is retired and lives down in Chatham. Yeah,
Chatham.
Yeah, he used to teach at Albany. Anyway, I was
Chatham, New York.
Yeah, Chatham, New York. Yeah.
I don't know where it is.
But anyway, John was very much involved with Bayless Manus in the early days. And what happened there was that Melville made the offer of the land. I was sent out, I remember, to take a look, and is this something we could consider? And I remember going out there with John Slocum. And John used to love his martinis, and so did Bayless Manus. And I don't know whether this is worth repeating, but John ended up having his own problems in that regard, and he's a hell of a, I mean, he still is, he's a, one of my good, close friends, and was a very, very, very capable guy. But anyway, he was about three sheets to the wind when I picked him up in the car, and it was a winter of whatever winter it was that went down there, and there had just had a heavy, wet, typical snow of Long Island, and about 6 or 8 inches of it had fallen down there. Well, I wanted to get a look at this particular site, and I knew it was wooded, but this is long before Nichols Road was ever cut in or anything else.
Right.
And so I drove up into the housing area that was up above, it's near the temporary parking, because of that housing that's up above the site, you know what I mean? It's on a higher level. That housing development has been there ever since we started. Well, if the sound is one way, the housing is in the other way. You know what I mean? The other direction. The sound is to the north. This must be to the south of the campus. So anyway, I parked the car up in there, and I had a map as to what the hell it was. And I had L.L. Bean boots on, and I mean, I was equipped to walk through there. John was going to see, he was going, well, I said, John, you're not going to see much. I just want to see what the hell some of these contours do, and I want to walk down here, and I'm going to walk right back. I said, you don't need to come. No, I'm going to come. John has a top coat on and black shoes and silk socks, black silk socks. And he starts walking out through the well. He got as far as the first fence, and he decided he'd turn around, but he was not in any condition to walk any distance. And when I finally come back, he had his shoes off and the heater going in the car, and he was wringing his socks out of it. And he never caught a cold, so that's how much martinis he had in him. Well, anyway, I did. I looked over the site. It was very difficult to picture what it was like because it was heavily wooded. I mean, it was the typical, the wooded areas that we now have are very typical of what it was like. But it was obvious that, with the tract of land that was there and the layout and so on, we immediately looked and see what we could do with the State Transportation Department and the Nassau County in terms of highway access, Suffolk County, and highway access and so on, and determined that it was possible to consider the Nichols Road extension as we brought it through there. That made it that made the site that much more attractive. And so we started with the campus planning. I went back and wrote a report agreeing that this site was an acceptable site for State University. Now, I say the reason why he did it, and it's obvious. If you look up the record, you will see that we got that site given to us in separate tracts of land. We never did. We didn't get it. We got it over a period of years.
You've got 340 acres, I think, to begin with, and then it wound up.
No. We got it in 60 acre parcels.
Oh, I see.
They were all defined legally in the area. We could get a parcel every place we needed it. And we could get a parcel and be a straight, but we got it in this 60 or however they broke the thing down, about 65 or 70 acres or something like that, parcels. Now, I think that one year we got double parcel, but that was unusual. We got these acres, and as I say, we figured it out on the map or on the campus development drawing that we had as to where we needed if we were going to be designing buildings there, you know what I mean, and we could get this, so we had the ownership of the land. But he was giving it to us in that way for tax purposes. That was the rationale. Now, as I say, Stony Brook, to get to where it is today with the problems it had, it entailed, was very, very fortunate because Ward Mill was one of them. Inasmuch as he had given the land and the way in which he was given it, he and his relationship to the council, his idea was that you were going to build a sleepy little Ivy League college, you know what I mean, in Stony Brook to go along with the Stony Brook Village restoration that he was involved in. Of course, our ideas were a little bit different than that because we were already working on the structure of the university and had earmarked Stony Brook as being one of the university centers.
Yeah.
I don't know when the master plan must have been in 58 that we first came up with the master plan for the university.
Was that prior to the Heald report or after the Heald report?
Oh, no. That was...
The Heald report, I think, was 58 or 59.
Well, it was almost along with the Heald report. I remember talking to people in the Heald report. You had to get the timing in there. But the structure of the university, of university centers and colleges, was something that was... that we had sort of settled into in the central office of...
After the Blagan report was turned down.
Turned down, yes, right. And we went with the decentralized, with the four... We, in fact, we entertained five university centers at the very beginning. We were thinking about Oswego, but it never got much thought. In other words, to hit a central place in New York. I mean, we had the southern tier with the expansion of Harper College.
Right, yeah, right.
And we hit the Buffalo area, but this was before we really had the merger settled with the University of Buffalo. We just simply had a Buffalo area. And then we hit the Oswego would have been geographically correct, you know what I mean, on Lake Ontario, Albany, and then Stony Brook. But Oswego quickly got, it didn't get the favor. It, it obviously wasn't there in terms of enrollment potential. Yeah, enrollment potentials that the others had. In any event, we went on with the site, and we started master planning. Now, the original master plan there, we used the same people that did the master plan in the very beginning at Binghamton, which was Moore and Hutchins. They were the original master plan architect. They were a very, in fact, even today, people will tell you that Moore and Hutchins were probably one of the early people in analyzing and doing campus master plans, because people point to the what they did for Goucher College in Maryland as one of the real first solid master plans for a new college campus. So they did the Harper College for us. Again, that started out as just a little college too. Just like, and then as we got started with the Stony Brook master plan, and we had a good master plan. In fact, we followed it for the most part.
You had some fingers. When I came in, somebody was telling me about a finger for science,
yeah,
finger for engineering.
Yeah. We had the master plan. We had a central core of the library and humanities and student activities administration. We had the housing that was down by the Nichols Road out in that particular direction and ringing the campus. We had a social science coming out from the social science humanities wing that became where the lecture hall center is, and that particular aspects in the social science facility. We had a science wing coming out from the library to another direction, and then we had an engineering wing, and then we had play fields and the physical education and athletics. So the master plan and the road network developed pretty well. The way in which we had decided that we would move on that particular campus was actually the way we ended up doing it. But in the meantime, we got another roadblock thrown in our way, because along comes changes in administration and people, political, I mean, it was long before we had the construction fund involved in the act, and things were happening, and people decided we weren't going fast enough. And the only way...
Who were the people?
Political.
Was this Frank Moore?
No, it was not Frank Moore. No, Frank Moore was perfectly satisfied with what we were doing.
Was this Harriman?
This was under Harriman's administration. And a guy by the name of Brill came into the act. He was the chair. He was appointed, whether he was a former general, what the hell he was, I don't know. But anyway, he was chairman of the Thruway Authority, I think. Well, this guy, Brill, came into the act. Whether he was from the telephone company or... No, I don't know what his connection was, but all of a sudden we were informed that the way we could get this thing started was to give the whole thing over to a single architectural firm. Our path was to do this. We were to take the master plan that was developed, and we were going to hire architectural firms for each one of these units they defined. We would have one for housing, one for the central core, one for the humanities, social science, one for the sciences wing, one for the engineering wing, and one for the probably student activities and physical education, and so on. So that we would have some prominent architectural firms working out. As it turns out, that's about what we did. But in the meantime, much to our chagrin, politically, we found out that what they were proposing here was to give this over to Voorhees, Walker, Smith, Smith, and Haynes, and said that this particular builder outfit was the architectural firm, had the size and ability to do this whole thing, and they would all be under one control.
Was this Phelan's?
No. This was before Phelan.
Yes,
this was before Phelan. Mm-hmm. So, actually, Mr. Teagan knew this firm. He had worked for Voorhees Walker.
I see.
In my estimation, they were not the firm to do this sort of thing with, and this was a mistake to do it this way. We were better off if we had stayed where we were. And then all hell broke loose. By this, I mean, why people didn't mind their P's and Q's, I don't know, but through Brill and through a guy by the name of Haynes and one of the Smiths at the architectural office, they went through and accepted this assignment without even though they were told that another architectural firm was already working on the project. Now, this is highly against the AIA ethics. I don't know if you've run into this before or not. But anyway, they were given this thing, and Moore and Hutchins stepped back, and then Mr. Moore and Mr. Hutchins went to the AIA and said, look, you know, you can do what you want to, but this is not ethically correct to have this sort of thing happening. And, you know, they at least needed the courtesy of a phone call, who they knew Ralph Walker quite well. Well, why the hell they did what they did, I don't know. I mean, but anyway, the whole thing went through a hearing with the AIA, and Boris Walker ended up to be censored, in which Haynes was suspended for 2 years and Smith 1 year, and Ralph Walker, a former president of the AIA, was censured. I mean, that's how serious a blow it was. Well, when I say it got off to a bad start, it got off to a bad start because, quite frankly, architecturally, Boris didn't have the ability to do what people said that they did. And I was rather taken aback. I was younger, and I had my own ideals and thoughts of way, and when I see the way in which the buildings were being developed down there, and the first building...